what's going on behind the scenes with your favorite Voice America show or host. For the latest news, visit the iRadio blog at iradioblog.com.
The following program is being brought to you on the Voice America Health and Wellness Channel. For more information about our network and to check our additional show hosts and topics of interest, please visit voiceamericahealth.com. The Voice America Talk Radio Network is the worldwide leader in live internet talk radio. Visit voiceamerica.com. The views and ideas expressed on the following program are strictly those of the host or guests and do not necessarily reflect the views and ideas held by the Voice America Talk Radio Network, its staff, and management.
Some people expect solutions to be expensive to be effective. This is not true. Everyone needs somebody who can be supportive and a guide. You'll find the answers you're looking for and the tools to both find answers and offer solutions on the Dr. Melanie Show. Now, here's your host, Dr. Melanie Barton.
Welcome to the Dr. Melanie Show on the Health and Wellness Channel of Voice America. Please read my new monthly newsletter at thedrmelanieshow.com. Have you been told, like me, that you have an abnormal protein in your blood that could lead to multiple myeloma? Well, you could really obsess about it. How will I know if I get it? What can I do to prevent it from developing into cancer? And what do those who do develop cancer have in common? And the questions go on and on. Dr. Landgren, senior investigator and attending physician from the National Cancer Institute, treats MGUS, which is what this abnormal protein diagnosis is called, and multiple myeloma patients. He's going to answer our questions. The second half of the show features Michelle Howe Clark talking about her soon-to-be-published book called Face Forward. It's her journey from the diagnosis of head and neck cancer through treatment, and not only surviving, but thriving. Let's listen first to my interview with Dr. Landgren. Okay, I am privileged today to have Dr. Landgren from the National Cancer Institute as my guest, and the reason I've invited him is he is an expert in MGUS, and I have been diagnosed with that. So thank you, Dr. Landgren, for being my guest today.
Thank you very much for having me. It's a great pleasure.
Well, I am very happy that you've taken time out of your busy schedule to do this. And for our listening audience, I know what MGUS stands for, but they probably don't. Can you tell them what that stands for, please?
MGUS stands for monoclonal gammopathy of undetermined significance, and it was coined in 1978 by Dr. Robert Kyle at the Mayo Clinic in Rochester, Minnesota. More specifically, it means that one can detect an abnormal immunoglobulin in the blood and or in the urine.
Okay. So I didn't know about the urine, so that's new to me. So if a person has MGUS, are they going to know they have it?
The vast majority of individuals who do have MGUS are unaware. Around 3% of the adult population above the age of 50 do have MGUS. Most people are completely unaware of it.
So how would somebody find out that they have it? How do you know to ask your physician or somebody to see if you have it?
So normally people are not asking about that because they are unaware of it, and physicians normally don't look for it either. And I think that probably is the right thing to do in 2012 because we don't have any therapy to offer, and there is really nothing we can do about the relationship between MGUS and potential subsequent things that could come following MGUS. MGUS usually detected in a very random way as part of a workup for a condition, just something that could be recurrent, for example, or individuals that do blood tests, and as part of that panel, they could find it. It could also be an checkup, or that could be other reasons. So the vast majority of people who get diagnosed with MGUS do it without really planning on doing it.
Okay. So is there a particular kind of blood test that they would have to have this show up?
So it's a particular test called electrophoresis that would capture MGUS. If an individual goes to the physician's office just for a regular checkup, normally the doctor would order a CBC, which includes the red cells, the white cells, and the platelets, and subsets of those white cells, as well as a CAM panel, including liver and kidney markers, as well as other markers that are part of the standard package. To do the electrophoresis, usually something that happens as a next step. Usually here in America, doctors check for total protein as part of the standard package, and if there is an elevation, that sometimes triggers the decision to go for an electrophoresis. But some doctors sometimes order it anyway, and then it could pan out. But I don't think that's the normal.
Okay. So if they have the blood test, or it shows up from some other resource that they were trying to get some other information, then does the patient panic, or how do they deal with this diagnosis?
Well, so similar to other tests that could pan out as abnormal, the doctor, of course, has to interpret it in the light of other tests and clinically and so forth. So the doctor has to, of course, tell the patient that this protein has been detected, and usually that would lead to some additional workup. It could be other blood tests, and depending on, for example, the concentration of the protein and the isotype, and there is something called free light chains, that it's another type of proteins that could be detected in the blood in around 30% of these individuals, and also could be detected in the urine. It could trigger, for example, a bone marrow biopsy to rule out that the patient does not have multiple myeloma, which is a cancer disease that is related to MGUS. It's a plasma cell cancer disease.
Okay. So the amount of the protein that you have, does that determine the potential of developing the multiple myeloma?
That is correct. It's one out of several variables. So the risk of developing myeloma has been found by the Mayo Clinic to be about 1% per year among individuals with MGUS. And that's the average risk.
Okay.
So patients who have, or individuals who have MGUS, they may have much, much lower risk. I think probably half the population who has MGUS probably has much lower risk. Then there are people who have higher risk, could be a couple of percents per year.
Okay.
What determines the risk is obviously the biology of the disease process. So if the concentration is higher, that's a reflection of more active biology. Also, there are certain isotypes, certain types of MGUS that are known to be more biologically active.
Hmm.
And also, I mentioned the free light chains. If those are being more abnormal, that's considered also to be a factor that is associated with activity. So a combination of these things, and there are things beyond this as well, and that's the type of things that doctors are looking for in the clinical setting.
Okay, and all the research that I've read, I didn't know there were different types of MGUS. So that's news to me. So I'll have to ask you more about that. Where can I read about the different types?
There are a lot of publications that are available online.
Okay.
And you can probably go and look at the International Myeloma Foundation's website.
Okay.
And also there is the Multiple Myeloma Research Foundation's website.
Okay.
And there is, for example, the Myeloma Beacon website.
Right.
And there are There are several other websites as well. And obviously there are printed, there must be printed material that could be useful as well.
Okay. Well, I will see if I can't find some of that and list those resources during when this show airs so that people who, like me, want to read more, they can do that. So I'm glad you told me that. So if a person has AMGUS, do they have any symptoms?
So according to the textbook, AMGUS is an asymptomatic condition. And that individuals that have AMGUS are completely unaware of that. I think that's probably true for the vast majority, but I also know that it's not entirely true. In fact, a lot of patients who have AMGUS that I see in clinic, and I see a lot of patients with myeloma, I see smoldering myeloma, I see AMGUS, I see a lot of other blood disorders every week. Out of the pool of individuals I see, there clearly is an enrichment for various types of symptoms in the category AMGUS. For example, many individuals, they have neurological symptoms, they can have endocrine abnormalities, they can have skin abnormalities, and there could be various other types of immune-related disturbances that, we see. So I think that the statement that AMGUS is always asymptomatic is not true, and I have to confess that I have also written many papers saying that it's an asymptomatic condition. It probably should be phrased that AMGUS, for the most part, is asymptomatic. That's probably more correct.
Well, as you study more patients with it, I guess you'll discover more things to, do more research on.
Right. We have patients who have actually quite severe symptoms, and we are treating these individuals. We are using strategies where we try to get at the plasma cells because we think that the plasma cells are releasing things that are impacting other organ systems.
Mm-hmm.
But this is a very complicated area to study because there are so many potential mechanisms. So it takes a lot of time to, really get at the details. But I think that the key thing to advance the field is really to understand the, target and the mechanism. If the target has been identified, then there is hope for a, cure. And that's true for any disease.
Okay. Well, I know a lot of my organs were affected when I was first diagnosed. I'm better now, but that's why they thought it was the multiple myeloma when I was first diagnosed. So I'm glad it's not, and I'm going to be reading more research to find out, you know, what can be done to hopefully keep me in the percentage that doesn't cross over into the multiple myeloma.
I think it's important to re-emphasize what I was saying before. The risk on average is around 1% per year, and it varies. But the other way of looking at it, and that's the way I personally, I am looking at it, is that it's a 99% chance that nothing will happen every year. Because life, as you know, is filled with a lot of risks. So if we take into account all the competing risks, maybe this risk is not the biggest risk out there. Typically, we tend to focus on things that we are aware of. I guess that's a human behavior. And the things, obviously, we don't know about, we don't focus on them. But we have to be a little bit sober when we think about this 1% risk on average. So I think really the key thing, in my opinion, is to do a careful workup and make sure that it really is AMGUS and it's determined the its actual risk profile. And if it turns out to be AMGUS and it's the lower risk, that's a good thing. Given that life has so many other risks, that that's really a low risk in dealing with here.
Well, you helped me to understand because what I read said over the lifetime there's a 25% chance, but you explained, can you explain how that 25% is derived at?
Yeah, so as I said, the Mayo Clinic studies, they have reported about 1% risk per year. So for an individual who gets diagnosed at a given age with a projected lifespan of additional 25 years, that would translate into around 25% accumulated risk over those 25 years. But again, it's a it's the average. So it's really an average estimate.
Okay. Well, it's time for us to take a break. So let's take a break, and we'll come back and talk some more.
Yeah, I look forward to that.
You're listening to Voice America Health and Wellness.
The incidence of autism has increased at an alarming rate. Approximately 1 in 150 children are affected by autism, giving autism the undesired ranking as the most prevalent childhood developmental disorder in the U.S. 67 children will be diagnosed today. That is nearly one child every 20 minutes. Autism One, a conversation of hope, hosted by Terry Aranga, illuminates how right now there is more reason than ever for individuals with autism spectrum disorders and their families to have the best hope for the brightest future. Autism is treatable, and given appropriate therapies, children are recovering. With well-known researchers and doctors, members of Congress, and expert service providers from a wide range of disciplines, Terry offers interviews and insights highlighting the progress in areas related to autism spectrum disorders such as biomedical research and treatment, communication, education, and behavioral modalities, sociological and philosophical issues, and legislative advocacy and insurance concerns. Autism One, a conversation of hope, broadcasts each Tuesday at 9 a.m. Pacific on the Voice America Health and Wellness Channel. Autism One, a conversation of hope. Through education and conversation, there is hope.
Opinions, options, answers. You're listening to Voice America Health and Wellness.
You're listening to the Dr. Melanie Show with your host, Dr. Melanie Barton. To participate in our discussion this week, please call toll-free 1-866-472-5792. That's 1-866-472-5792. Or send an email to drmelaniebarton@gmail.com. Now, back to our program.
Welcome back to the Dr. Melanie Show on the Health and Wellness Channel of Voice America. We're talking to Dr. Landgren about monoclonal gammopathy of undetermined significance, or MGUS, a precursor to multiple myeloma. Now let's return to that interview. All right, before the break, Dr. Landgren, we were talking about various things about MGUS, and you mentioned about multiple myeloma, different kinds, like smoldering myeloma. What is the difference between the different types of multiple myeloma?
So MGUS and smoldering myeloma are considered to be precursor states that are not active, causing symptoms. Multiple myeloma is a clinical diagnosis that typically has symptoms. So the book says that for patients who do have multiple myeloma, you have the M protein, the abnormal protein in the blood and or in the urine. Mm-hmm. You have the plasma cells in the bone marrow. Usually they are 10% or more.
Okay.
But because it's a clinical diagnosis, and this is how the textbook is written, patients with myeloma, they have to have one out of four conditions related to it. So they have to have hypercalcemia, high levels of calcium. They have to have kidney failure, they have to have anemia, or they have to have detectable bone lesions by imaging with X-ray. So okay. One or more of those would qualify for myeloma.
Okay.
So how is smoldering myeloma different from multiple myeloma? So smoldering myeloma is not allowed to have these clinical manifestations. That would immediately, by the textbook, make the diagnosis multiple myeloma.
Ah.
So now you have plasma cells, and you have these proteins in the blood and or in the urine. So how is MGUS and smoldering different? So that's a laboratory cutoff that has been defined there. So if it's less than 3 grams per deciliter of the protein, and if it's less than 10% plasma cells, then MGUS would be the correct diagnosis. If one or both of those are above the threshold, it would be smoldering myeloma.
Okay.
Now, do I believe this is true biologically? Actually, I don't.
No.
I'm not sure that smoldering myeloma truly exists. I think it's probably a condition that it's continuous. I think there are patients in that probably are more in the direction of patients in this group smoldering that are more like early.
Mm.
So I think in the future, be many more sophisticated markers that will allow doctors to those individuals who really have the early, that could make stage for early intervention studies to actually start treating earlier. And one could envision, I don't know this, and it needs to be tested and proven in clinical studies, but it's possible that could significantly delay the risk of developing myeloma for those individuals who have the high-risk precursor state. And
if they're treated for those conditions, you mean?
Exactly. And it's, I mean, it's possible that it could even potentially cure some patients. As of today, multiple myeloma, unfortunately, for the most part, is an incurable disease. But maybe, and I have to keep on saying maybe because we don't know this, but maybe it's because we have treated myeloma when it's quite fulminant disorder. That's how it's being treated today, because people are looking for these symptoms I mentioned with fractures and kidney failure. That means that the disease has gone pretty far along. So I think this is a very interesting and very intriguing time when we actually can test this, because we have very sophisticated methods and we have access to so many new drugs that have just been around for less than 10 years, and there are new drugs coming virtually every 6 months. So I'm extremely optimistic about that.
Well, good. So if a person has been diagnosed with MGUS and they get a fracture or they start having kidney function problems, that would be an indicator they really need to get checked to see if they have the smoldering?
Well, so if a fracture were to happen or a kidney failure were to develop, that would immediately go right into multiple myeloma.
Because,
as I said, these are the clinical manifestations that are associated with the diagnosis multiple myeloma.
So if a person has MGUS and they did things to keep their calcium levels, they show high calcium in the bloodstream if it's coming out of the bone marrow, correct?
So if an individual has MGUS and starts showing signs of high calcium, hypocalcemia, that would also be consistent with multiple myeloma. And because the plasma cells that are part of the MGUS, part of the smoldering myeloma, part of the multiple myeloma disease, and they are related with each other, because those cells are located in the bone marrow, which is part of the skeleton, they chew on the bone, and the bone contains calcium. So calcium will be released and go out in the blood, and it could then impact, for example, the kidneys and other organ systems and cause more problems. If those destructive processes get out of control, they could also cause fractures of the skeleton. So that's what I'm trying to describe when I say that I think that the way we are thinking about multiple myeloma in 2012, and we have been thinking about it for many, many years, is that it's a clinical diagnosis that's very advanced, but maybe in the future, and I personally think that that's the way we are heading, we hopefully can capture those cases that are earlier, and I'm not talking about treating MGUS, because there are very many individuals with MGUS, and the vast majority will never, ever have any problems. But there is a tip of the iceberg that probably will develop myeloma over time. So if we can sort out, if you could identify those individuals, and then we could offer them an earlier treatment, that would be a dramatic change of the paradigm.
Well, if you can study that 1%, to go backwards to find out what do they have in common of when they had MGUS, to maybe then treat whatever it is that might help prevent it from developing.
Exactly. And in fact, we are doing that as we speak. At the National Cancer Institute, we do have a study that is open and is open for enrollment. So for individuals who do have MGUS or do have smoldering myeloma, they can go on our study. And we are following these individuals. We do tests, and we are looking for exactly those types of things you are mentioning. We are looking for markers that we know are associated with disease activity. And for individuals who do progress, we are trying to do sequential samples so we can compare these samples over time. it's a lot of work, but the goal for us is to identify the mechanisms that drive transformation and use that as a map to design treatments to prevent and delay transformation. So it's a huge effort.
Mm-hmm. So help me to understand, if a person has a high concentration of calcium in their blood, does that mean that they are eliminating the calcium out of their body and they need to replace it, or does it mean it's too high and they don't need to take calcium supplements?
Can you please repeat the question?
Okay. If a person has blood work done and it shows that they have high calcium levels in their blood, does that mean that they don't need to take calcium supplements, or they do need to take calcium supplements?
Well, so if an individual has high levels of calcium for any reason, that could potentially could be a dangerous thing, okay. Because calcium is involved in a lot of organ systems. It's actually a vital thing in most cells of the body. So, for example, if an individual has very high calcium, it could, for example, cause very dangerous things in the heart. The heart could technically stop if you have very, very high levels of calcium. You don't want that, obviously, to happen.
No.
It could impact your kidneys, for example, and there are a lot of other things that could happen. You could be very much impacted in your brain. You would have a kind of a slower thinking processes going on. So the whole body would be impacted and beyond what I'm telling you.
Mm-hmm.
So having very high levels of calcium is something that you don't want to have. You have to have that controlled and corrected. Next question, and that's the question that the doctor always thinks, is why does this happen? And obviously there are a lot of underlying potential causes for things like that. So the doctor needs to do a workup. It could be an endocrine disease. It could be MGUS. It could be multiple myeloma, or there could be some other diseases as well. So the first thing is to make sure that it gets safe. And the next thing for the doctor is to figure out what's going on.
All right. Well, that was what they told me. They were looking for that in my blood.
Yeah.
And luckily it wasn't there, so I'm very glad about that. So if a person has been diagnosed with MGUS, what should they do? What can they do to help themselves?
So as I said before, MGUS on average is around 1% risk of developing myeloma per year.
Mm-hmm.
The other way of looking at it is it's 99% chance that nothing will happen every year,
mm-hmm.
and that's a very good deal. So I think, first of all, having MGUS is not the worst thing that could happen. Obviously, life has a lot of risks. If you put in all the other risks, the competing risks, that's probably one of the lower risks in life, really. Having MGUS is something that the clinical guidelines suggest that one should see a doctor if that were to happen, that one gets diagnosed with MGUS. And the guidelines say that the doctor should follow patients who have certain features annually. For patients with really low risk, either the patient and the doctor may decide to check it annually, but the newest guidelines that recently came out suggest that maybe those patients don't need to be followed because the risk is so low.
Oh,
I think
okay.
That's probably up to the individual patient and his or her doctor to decide on that. But usually the recommendations are that usually patients are being seen on an annual basis with a blood test, so not repeat the bone marrow, not do a lot of additional x-ray, not do a lot of other things, but have just a clinical visit and do the standard workup, including the electrophoresis. That would be the standard.
Okay. Well, this has been most informative and very helpful, so I truly appreciate you giving us this information and taking the time to do it. So thank you.
It's my pleasure. Thank you very much for having me. I really enjoyed it.
And if somebody wants more information, can they go look at the National Cancer Institute website to get more information?
Absolutely. So the National Cancer Institute's website is www.cancer.gov.
Okay.
And that's the Cancer Institute's general website. We who work here in Bethesda, Maryland, we are part of the so-called intramural program of the National Cancer Institute. So we provide clinical care, and we do so-called correlative science integrated with the care. So we do all this research as part of the clinical mission. And we are part of the Center for Cancer Research, the CCR. And patients can Google that, and that should show up on top of the Google search. And on the internet, you will also see how to contact us with telephone numbers and all that.
All right. Well, thank you so much. I truly appreciate this, and we might have you come back at a later date to talk about present research. How about that?
Oh, that sounds fun. Thank you very much. I really enjoyed it.
Well, I did too. Thank you so much.
A healthy dialogue for your lifestyle. Voice America Health and Wellness.
As our loved ones grow older, we often have questions about their future care and well-being. Today's senior citizens are faced with issues relating to health care, aging well, long-term care, and legal issues. For the answers, tune in to Senior Matters with host Nadir Wright. Nadir has spent much of his life providing answers to senior issues such as help in the home, decisions, and making growing older a wonderful experience. Tune in to Senior Matters every Thursday at 10 a.m. Eastern Time, 7 a.m. Pacific on the Voice America Health and Wellness Channel.
Your life, your health, your network. You're listening to Voice America Health and Wellness.
You're listening to the Dr. Melanie Show with your host, Dr. Melanie Barton. To participate in our discussion this week, please call toll-free 1-866-472-5792. That's 1-866-472-5792. Or send an email to drmelaniebarton@gmail.com. Now, back to our program.
Welcome back to the Dr. Melanie Show on the Health and Wellness Channel of Voice America. Dr. Landgren told us we don't really have to worry about MGUS developing into multiple myeloma. Thank goodness. Now we're going to talk to Michelle Howe Clark and talk about her book, Face Forward, her journey from surviving to thriving from her diagnosis of head and neck cancer. Welcome, Michelle.
Thank you so much, Melanie. It is such a pleasure to be here.
Well, I am very glad that you've taken time out of your busy schedule, mother of two and entrepreneur and all the other activities you now do.
Thank you so much. It's a juggle, but it's a beautiful juggle.
It is. So tell our listeners exactly what kind of cancer is it that you were diagnosed with?
I was diagnosed with adenoid cystic carcinoma of the parotid gland, which is the salivary gland.
Oh, okay. That's quite rare, isn't it?
It is rare, especially in one as young as I was. I was 33. And it's a very aggressive and very rare type of cancer, but it's even rarer in a young person.
And do they have any clue as to why you got it? I mean, is there anything genetic or anything in research that says why somebody your age would develop it?
Nothing as of yet. They don't really know what the triggers are.
Okay. Well, that'll be something for the National Cancer Institute to research. That would be a good thing. So tell our listeners, what was your life like before the diagnosis? Because it's quite different now.
It is. So for me, let me ask you, your listeners, a question. Have you ever had the experience where you're standing and the next thing you know, the rug has just been pulled right out from under you and you land on your butt?
Yeah, I know that feeling.
Yes. Well, that's pretty much what happened to me. I was trucking along beautifully in my life. I was a mother of a 6-month-old beautiful little girl. I had a lovely marriage to a very handsome and wonderful man, my husband, Dwayne. And I was a vice president investment banker. I'd just been promoted, and I was living the high life in New York City, and nothing could be better. Mm-hmm. And then my life was shattered by a diagnosis of aggressive head and neck cancer. And then one of the first decisions that I had to make was, did I want to live and die young, a pretty corpse, or sacrifice all of my right facial nerves for a chance, not a guarantee, mind you, but a chance to live. So that was my first really big decision. Did I want to be disfigured and live, or do I want to die young and beautiful?
And your decision was?
Well, I feel like one of the things that I need to tell is how that was broken to me. So I had just come out of my first operation, and it was supposed to be a benign tumor. There's a whole story behind that. I had gotten it tested, and it was supposed to be a benign tumor. It was supposed to be a routine operation, and in and out, back to work in 4 days, and nothing more to it. The only risk was that perhaps they would nick a facial nerve when they were removing whatever benign tumor was there. So when I went into the hospital, it ended up that when they went in, it was massively out. It was cancer in a massive way, and it had grown outside of the salivary gland, up to my temporal bone, down into my shoulder muscles, and invaded all of my facial nerves on the right side. So from a in-and-out operation to, holy cow, you know, we're about to face some things that we never thought we'd face in our lifetime. And
yes.
When I woke, sorry, go right ahead.
No, I'm just going, wow, yes.
I know. Just talking about it kind of gets me, I either laugh or cry. I don't know, you know, it depends on the day. Today is a laughing day, which is, you know, emotions are interesting that way. But when I woke up and I saw my husband's face, I could tell he had been crying, and my husband just doesn't cry very often at all. So I knew something was up. And when I went up, when I got wheeled up, he told me right then, he said, Michelle, it wasn't benign, it's cancer, and it's serious. And that was not your only operation. There'll be more. So I got wheeled up to my room, and my sister and my brother. I have another sister, but she was too far away to get there so quickly. But my sister and my brother were there, and my husband. And my doctor comes in, and he sits down at the end of the bed, and he says, "You know, we're going to have to take out all of your facial nerves on the right side." And you know, he went on to tell me, you know, that my face would be slack, that I would drool, that I would dribble food, that I'd likely never speak correctly again, that my eye wouldn't close, that I would have to put a gold weight in my eye. And then he put his hand on my calf and he said, "And I understand. Most of my patients, I'm a head and neck surgeon in New York City, and most of my patients would choose death. And I respect your decision." And right there, Melanie, life surged up from within my, you know, the deepest resources of me, the will to live, surged up like a lion. And I knew at that moment, I'll live disfigured. Yes, I will.
Yes. Yeah. And do you think your six-month-old daughter had something to do with that decision?
I really do. I do believe that she had a significant role to play, because the first thing words that came out of my mouth was, "Yes, but I have a six-month-old daughter."
And it wasn't an easy journey with her trying to go through all these surgeries, because that wasn't the only surgery, like you said.
Right. No, there turned out that there ended up to be 5 surgeries. So that was the first. The second was to remove my facial nerves, and I did something unique in that next phase. And I really want to shout out to your audience to say, you know, when you're in facing these times of trouble, and that's what the book is called, Face Forward, Meeting Challenges Head On in Times of Trouble, know that you can pause. Like, I know that the direction is move quickly, keep going down the track. But for me, that doctor who told me that he would respect my decision to die, and then I went into his office to get some, you know, I was cracked open from my middle of my skull all the way down to my neck, and my ear had been removed and put back on, kind of like a peeling back from the skull, if you can imagine that. And when I was getting, you know, going for the follow-up checkup before the second operation, he handed me a jar of about 350, a prescription, not to say a jar, a prescription for about 350 maximum strength painkillers, almost as if to say, this really is terrible, why don't you go and get numb and just, you know, just disconnect from your life. So I knew that he wasn't speaking the language I needed. I needed a language of hope. I needed a language of something else. So I immediately paused. I said, this doctor's not for me. I'm a doctor's daughter, and my father had passed away. But my mother was, you know, better a good doctor than someone who has nice bedside manner. And I said, no, Mom, better good side, you know, a good doctor with good bedside manner.
Yeah, you can have both, yes.
Exactly. I wasn't going to settle for less. And through serendipity and 6 degrees of separation, I actually found my way to an amazing doctor who, when I went in to see him, his name is Dr. Cosentino, when I went in to see him, the first thing that he said is, I know this is hard, honey, but we're going to try to get you to your daughter's wedding.
Yay.
And I said, that's right. that's the language I need to hear.
Right.
And exactly. And I knew I'd found my guy. So I went through.
I am so glad that you had the desire to look for the right person rather than to settle.
That's right, because gosh only knows where I would have landed. Mm-hmm. I might have just jumped into that vat of pain pills and never come out.
Yes, and not be alive today.
That's right. That's so true.
How long has it been now since your diagnosis?
8 years. 8 years.
Oh, I didn't realize it'd been that long. Okay.
Yeah, 8 years, and it's, one of the things I was listening to, your last speaker, and one of the things that I just want to pull out of the hat, for everybody listening right now, is that though I understand averages and I understand statistics, what every person out there needs to know is that you are not a statistic. You are not an average. You are an individual. Therefore, no averages and no statistics apply to you. You are a 0% and 100% chance. And that was something that I grabbed onto that and I held on. So my statistics were dire. I shouldn't be here. I shouldn't have made it to any of these years I have. But if I had clung to those statistics, I might have just willed kind of believed myself to be part of them.
Yeah. I'm glad that you are a fighter and that you did not settle for what could have been. So, well, how about, this is a good place for us to take a break so we can come back and talk about your life now. How about that?
Awesome. That sounds great.
Okay. Thanks.
A healthy dialogue for your lifestyle. Voice America Health and Wellness.
Do you remember what life was like when you were young? Having the mobility and ability to play all day and then sleep through the night without needing coffee in the morning? For the majority of us, gone are those days. But they don't have to be. Transforming Health with Brad King will show you how you can awaken your youthful energy potential and live a disease-free life of abundant energy and vitality. Transforming Health is broadcast live every Wednesday at noon Pacific, 3 p.m. Eastern on Voice America Health and Wellness.
Opinions, options, answers. You're listening to Voice America Health and Wellness.
You're listening to the Dr. Melanie Show with your host, Dr. Melanie Barton. To participate in our discussion this week, please call toll-free 1-866-472-5792. That's 1-866-472-5792. Or send an email to drmelaniebarton@gmail.com. Now, back to our program.
Welcome back to the Dr. Melanie Show on the Health and Wellness Channel of Voice America. We're talking to Michelle Howe Clark about her thriving after her survival from head and neck cancer. So, Michelle, let's talk about the good stuff now. You survived the head and neck cancer, but you're thriving now. So how is your life different now?
Absolutely. Thanks for asking. I'm wondering if your listeners can relate to the feeling of just kind of eking it out, just kind of getting from day to day. And I was there for a long time. I had to, one of the things that I needed to do was accept that I was where I was. And that was like it took me a minute to just accept that I was disfigured, to just accept that, I might drool food, to accept that, my husband has to look at a woman who looks differently. So that acceptance was a process for me. But in that acceptance, I woke up. When this crisis hit, I was awake. I was awake, and I think I was walking around a little numb, a little kind of in a gauze wrapping, just getting to work, getting home, watching TV, going out and partying, and then just keeping doing that. But when you wake up and you're given this crisis that just arouses all of your innate resources, and all of the piercing beauty of life comes to the forefront, and all the things that you had pressed down, all the things that I had put down in my life and said, later, I'll get to those later, they were like, you get to them now. You know what I mean? You'll find a way to put those into your life in every moment. And so that's what my life became, you know, because I could spend my life dying to live, or I could spend my life living until I died. And I definitely am on the living until I die.
So, and we're so glad you are.
Thank you so much. So, you know, I'm not going to spend my time wondering the what ifs. And one of the really powerful things that I started to do in the beginning was I was saying, why me? You know, why now? Why this? Right? And that just threw me in a loop of suffering. It just put me in a circular mentality of your mind is programmed to answer questions. And it would answer the question for me, because you aren't good enough, because you're not valuable, because you deserve this, right? But when I flipped that why to why do I want to live? Why do I want to love? Why do I matter? The backing the why with what is your meaning, now my brain was answering those questions in a powerful way that was giving me tools to know that I could handle this, to know that I could enjoy actually being in pain. It's a weird thing to say, because in life, pain is inevitable. We will all experience pain.
That's
suffering. Right. Yeah, suffering is a choice. Mm-hmm. Suffering is a choice we make when we decide to stick in our story, because we're all narrating our lives all the time. We are telling the story of our lives to ourselves, and in that narration holds our power. We can actually tell the story from a new and improved perspective.
Mm-hmm. It has to do with our attitude about our situation.
That's absolutely correct. Absolutely correct. And that's what I started to do. I started to ask for help. Like that first story where I told you that I went out and I asked for a better doctor, I never stopped. I just kept asking, help me. Help me get well. Who do I need? What do I need? Calling all resources. And I was just out there, you know, beating the streets in a way. I found myself at Gilda's Club, which is an amazing resource. I found myself at Exceptional Cancer Patients, which is an amazing resource. I found myself with the Block Foundation, you know, reading those amazing works that they put out there for free. I found myself on the NCI site researching what I can, not looking at statistics. You know, those statistics weren't going to help me, but looking for resources. What experimental drugs were out there? What's going on in my world? Do you know what I mean? So I went on a mission to really get informed about how I could become a member of my healthcare team. You know, a lot of people like think medicine is done to you, but guess what? You're the head of your healthcare team.
That's right.
Yeah, so I moved from being a member, just kind of getting on the team, and then I realized, hey, I'm heading this, I'm the captain of this team.
Yes.
And I stepped into that powerful role.
And it's changed your life.
It has changed my life, and it's helped me find, you know, because my whole goal with Face Forward, meeting challenges head on, is to provide that light, because that light wasn't there for me. I was in darkness. I was suffering night terrors when I came back from my second operation, and my face was torn up. I looked like Elephant Woman on the right side of my face, because what caused the second, the third, fourth, and fifth operations were the fact that my sight never healed. It stayed infected.
Oh.
So I had two fissures, which are holes made from your body from the inside out to get rid of stuff. I had two fissures grow in my ear on the right side. So I had like three ear holes, and on this amazing green mucusy pus was flowing out of my head like the never-ending fountain. It was horrific. And then when, you know, the third operation happened, I had to actually, they had to remove so much of my flesh that for about 4 months I had to stuff gauze into my ear. And every night I'd be like a magician pulling this green gauze out of my yards of it, just pulling gauze out of, because it was soaking up all of that infection. But in all of that, I found the ability to own my authentic no. Because as women in our society, we feel very obligated to other people. We feel obligated to put other people before ourselves and to say yes, when sometimes it's the last thing we want to do. But guess what? I said no. When I meant no, I meant no. And when I said yes, I meant yes. And my gosh, there is so much power in that simple thing, Just saying. And you know what? No is a full sentence.
I like
no.
That.
You don't have to say no because da-da-da-da-da, right? You can say no.
Just and that's the end of the statement. I like and that.
Yeah.
I'll have to remember that. So tell them about one of the things you have in your book is a term. It's called take a goal stroll. Tell them what that is.
Yes, and that is so powerful. Now, a goal stroll, I call it many different things. I call it a goal stroll. I call it a resource journey. But basically what you can do is when you have these crises in life, you know, all of this will and the different pieces of your life that matter to you will surge forth. And in that, you might actually begin to catch the tail of your desire, like your gift. Everybody is a gift. Everyone is a light. We all have so much to share. And when you're aroused in your life by crisis, sometimes the desire that you were put here to share becomes evident. And we want to feel like kids in a candy store about life. Whenever you feel that moment where you're like, this is it, like you could be looking at a sunrise, you could be looking at a sunset, you could be looking at a rainbow, at a laughing baby's face, and you feel that connection, you actually are resonating at such a high vibration. And by vibrating in that for longer, you can actually move forward and create a way, a goal stroll. So the goal stroll itself is when you're in a high vibration, and you can create high vibrations in many ways. Laughing is one, just, you know, kind of forcing a laugh out can actually make you feel better, because even if you're not feeling the laugh is working for you. So let's say that you just feel like you're down in the dumps, you need to do something about it, you can actually start to laugh, allow yourself to get caught by that laughter, and then in that moment where you feel that click, like, ah, I feel a little better, imagine, use that imagination and start to create a way. Allow yourself to step into who you want to be, perhaps versus who you are right now, because we're always creating the next moment in the now moment. So why not create the next moment as you'd like it to be versus as you don't want it to be? So by working with goal strolling and just really knowing that you're in a high vibration and then taking that into your mind and using that high vibration to help you create a way forward, it could be just a vision of a perfect life in that moment that you're laughing, a vision of your life as you want it to be, and you've created momentum in your life to have more of the same.
So it sounds like you're living that.
I am living that, and I say there is no trying. I am-ing it.
Oh, I like that.
Yeah.
That's good. You also mentioned that intention is very important. What do you mean by that?
Yes. And intention, so, you know, some of my friends say that's a sophisticated word. Not everybody wants to hear about intention. You know, they might be all intentioned out because it's kind of being used so much. But when there's so much power in our language, you know, when we wish and hope and want and can't and should, I mean, we should ourselves to death, I tell you this, especially women, we just keep shoulding ourselves, I should have done this, I should have done that. But by saying I intend that I am going to be on time, I intend that I will be well, you're actually like rolling out the red carpet, you're creating a path for yourself to follow. And it's not hoping, because hope leaves room for doubt. It's not wishing, because that also leaves it out there in another place where you're wishing for it. You're intending it. You're creating a way to get there. Just by changing our words, our language, we create paths that can actually create tangible results in our lives.
Okay. So if people want your book, when's it coming out?
It's coming out March 20th.
Okay.
And it'll be in bookstores and on Amazon. It isn't in Kindle form currently, and you can find it at Face Forward, meaning challenges head on. And also, you can find me at Receive Believe, which is, you know, my overarching philosophy is ask, allow yourself to receive, and believe that you can.
Okay. Well, thank you so much, Michelle. I really appreciate you're taking the time and sharing your story, and I hope they'll go get your book.
Well, thank you so very much. I really appreciate it.
All right. Well, now it's time to wrap up today's show. You can reach Dr. Landgren at cancer.gov, and you can reach Michelle at Receive Believe. Next week, author Julia Shopik will talk about four different inexpensive treatments for life-threatening diseases.
Malcolm West will discuss the one that he used. To access information about glutathione, go to my storefront and click on drmelanie.maxforyou.com. Remember to help yourself help someone else. Until next week, goodbye for now.
Thank you so much for joining us this week for the Dr. Melanie Show. Please join your host, Dr. Melanie Barton, again next Thursday at 10 a.m. Pacific Time, 1 p.m. Eastern Time, on the Voice America Health and Wellness Channel. We'll see you next week for another great program.